Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I can't quit you, babe. But I've got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I can't quit you, babe. But I've got to put you down.
I can't quit you, babe, but I gotta put you down for a while. Hey, man, it is December 31st, and in this case, a while just winds up happening to be like a week and a half. That's all we gotta put down boxing for, a week and a half, because boxing's returning very fast. Hey, everybody, I'm Patrick Connor. Welcome back to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio Show, my friends. Just a sec. My buddy Bryn Jonathan Butler is going to be with us. We're doing an end of the year show. That means we're doing, you know, all the regulars, knockout of the year, fight of the year. Maybe we'll do an upset of the year, although, you know, that's pretty obvious what that one should be. We'll go through the good, the bad, the ugly, the ridiculous, the Bobby Chez, the everything, my friends. That's what we're doing tonight. If you ain't got nothing to do, nobody's listening to this. Come on, nobody's listening to this live. This is New Year's Eve. You ain't inside. And if you are, good for you, because there's probably a lot of drunk assholes out there right now. So in just a moment, my buddy Bryn is going to join us, going to have a lot of fun. You know, I'm not going to lie to you guys, man. Since this is a fairly, I don't know, somewhat personal show, we don't really get all that many listens anymore. You know, there was a time when we were getting a lot of listens. We don't get the traffic and listens that we used to get. But that being said, you know, because of that, I think it's probably a slightly more personal show. There are probably a lot more listeners who, like, you know semi-personal things about Bryn and I and Aris and I than, you know, a lot of other people. 2019 was rough for me, you guys. 2019 was not my year. 2019 was not an easy year for me. I'll spare you guys the details and the sobs and all that type of stuff. There's no point. Just about anything, you know, if you know me well, then you probably already kind of know, but 2019 was a trying year for me, and I'm definitely ready to, like, leave it, you know, at least metaphorically in the rear view mirror. At the end of the day, I guess it's just another day between December 31st and January 1st. It's still 24 hours. It's like any other day in that regard. So it's kind of foolish to pick an arbitrary date like January 1st to change things or start doing things differently or start working out or eating better or talking to your parents or whatever the fuck it is that you need to do. But I mean, you know, I guess at the end of the day, it does wind up feeling like a new beginning, winds up feeling like some sort of transition. And that's not anything new. It's obviously going back many hundreds of years historically over the winter solstice, blah, 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 blah. Point is, regardless of how foolish it may seem to, you know, assign calendar days and things like that to change your ways, nonetheless, I'm looking forward to 2020 and looking forward to leaving 2019 behind and hoping that the actual numerical year was what was messing me up. And hopefully that's the case. But boxing wise, I would say that the year had a kind of strange arc. I think that most boxing fans would probably agree. DAZN and the developments of a lot of streaming apps and kind of changes in the way that boxing fans consume the sport. You know, those things, a lot of those things really developed and pushed forward in 2019. In some ways, that was bad because it widened the rift between some promotional entities in the sport. But in other regards, it is making the sport more accessible to boxing fans overall and giving them a pretty wide variety of things to watch. That has been something that's been building. It's not all on DAZN. those kinds of things have been in development for a long time, and they were bound to go in that direction, considering the direction in which the rest of technology, social media, media in general, and society are going. It's just that for whatever reason, this is something we've talked about many times, boxing tends to just be very slow to catch up in comparison to, a lot of the other sports specifically. So it's kind of nice to see at least some changes. That being said, hang tight one second, man. I got to take a drink of beer. Come on now. Ah, thanks. Thank you for bearing with me. But the changes, I'm curious in 2020 what that's going to mean and what that's going to bring. Because despite the development, despite the forward momentum that the technology seems to be affording the sport of boxing, despite that, there does seem to definitely be, I'm not looking for the right word. I guess there's going to have to be a turning point or a point at which it's not going to work in its current iteration. So I'm curious what's going to happen. Bryn, what are you drinking? What's up, man? How you doing?
I'm drinking iced coffee in a 55-ounce Bubba mug.
Perfect.
Because I'm old.
True, and also not a drinker, and therefore untrustworthy.
I don't trust me either. Yeah, but I mean, foresight is 2020.
That's Chess site is 20 whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you never know. You don't know if there's going to be a roadblock or not, so I mean, you take your chances.
You do take the chances. So, man, what's like if you had a couple words or something like that to describe boxing in 2019, how was your 2019 and what was boxing like for you in 2019?
I thought it was interesting. I mean, I'd have to start from the top. I mean, just Andy Ruiz. The upset over Joshua was, I think, the most unexpected thing. I think it had a lot of positive aspects to it in terms of I really enjoyed, though it was rather brief, having a Mexican American heavyweight champion for the first time. The rematch was there, which was disappointing because I hope he was kind of not going to follow the path of Buster Douglas and in the end mirrors it. I loved Donaire. Inoue was, I think, my favorite fight of the year. Just coming off of the Gamboa fight, that was a little hard to watch. I thought, I mean, yeah, it's I thought there was a lot of good aspects to it. Canelo had another great year. I thought his knockout of Kovalev is very worthy of praise. It's a big challenge. I think he's doing a lot of things to be great, and I think we're finding greatness in his performances. I think he's improving. I love that he's striving to make definitive statements almost every round that he fights. And, I was hoping Gervonta Davis would look a little better than he did against Gamboa, but I still think, he's a fun prospect to watch. I'm excited to see Lomachenko probably box circles around him, but I mean, he's a dangerous fighter still. So I think that, boxing has a lot of fun characters to follow. I hope it can get out of its own way and create the matchups that we're really pining for. And then there's the weirdness of maybe Mayweather coming out of retirement in 2020, which I just think there's so much money on the table. And the people who signed Pacquiao obviously did it with that being a distinct possibility because Pacquiao just isn't the draw he used to be, and the only way they can make their money back is the sort of Mayweather sweepstakes. So I think there's a chance for that in 2020, even though I think it's an absurd fight. I still will watch it. So there's lots to like, and lots of frustrating stuff too. I mean, overall, were you happy with it?
I felt it was definitely a mixed bag. For all of the new developments that we have, for instance, like what I was saying with DAZN and like the kind of the development of the consumer technology that boxing fans are hooking into. You know, I would say that that's overall, that's a net positive. The fact that boxing fans are in general, I was just about to say being subject to, although that would probably be pretty fucking accurate, but you know, boxing fans now just have a wider array of boxing to watch and on, far more different platforms and channels, generally speaking, good thing. You know, briefly, quick side anecdote. I've said this before on the history shows, mostly just out of kind of nostalgic remembrance, but you know, it's also pertinent here. I remember back in the early 2000s, I mean, maybe like mid 2000s, when streaming, quote unquote, you know, illegally became really a thing, or at least became far more widespread. There were a couple of platforms that were like, you know, bootleg platforms. One was called Sopcast, for instance, that used to have a few channels where it was like reliable for like 4 or 5 years for real, where every single Saturday night or whatever it was, whether it was MMA or boxing, like there was a 99% chance that shit was going to be on there. Might not have been great quality, but it was on there. But, you know, international shows, you know, things of that nature, it was kind of like, you know, it was a crapshoot. They may or may not have had it, blah, blah, blah. Now you can watch some fucking gymnasium show in Bulgaria live, courtesy of like a handful of people on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, because they're really that sick about this shit. And I mean, we are too, but holy shit. So these kinds of developments are great. They're awesome. Rather than having to, in 2001, read Joe Koizumi's updates about fights in Asia, because there's no way in shit any of us are ever going to actually lay our eyes on them, we can actually lay our eyes on them now. That's a great thing. But then, of course, we're also seeing the back end of that, which is that this is kind of just being thrust out there. It's like basically how marijuana was legalized in a few states without any sort of like regulation or any sort of plan as to what the fuck to do. And believe me, I'm not at all decrying the legalization of marijuana, but you know, these things weren't planned for. And similarly with DAZN and a number of these other platforms, it's kind of just like blah, it kind of got shotgun blasted out there, and they're still kind of in the process of seeing what works. DAZN is obviously very much in the process of figuring out what doesn't work production-wise every single week. But, you know, there are a number of kind of push and pull things here. So I think that that's probably the biggest story of 2019 as far as the direction of boxing and whether or not these kinds of developments can mean something good or meaningful for fans. Like, for instance, can these type of developments, you know, bring enough attention to the sport and bring enough heft that we can finally demand that something like Spence Crawford happens? You know, we're still remains to be seen where Errol Spence is at, but things like that. So, you know, like you mentioned before, boxing kind of standing in its own way, preventing itself from doing well a lot of the times. And that's what I would like to see. I'd like to see those barriers broken down a little bit, even just in the interest of money, even if that's all it is, you know, even if it's just in the interest of, we need to get this shit done now and strike while the iron is hot type of shit rather than slow playing. Cause I do kind of fear at times that the slow playing marination shit for every single fight is going to wind up dragging the sport down a little more than, you know, it already has been in the last few decades. All right. That was a really long rant. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No. No, but I mean, it was pretty cogent to I think what a lot of the central issues are, and, as these guys become less and less active, you know, a lot of these opportunities, what we had in, you know, 2018, we had these three undefeated, interesting heavyweights creating, you know, like a really exciting couple years of, you know, some people were hailing it as a golden age. I think when I got enthusiastic with Joshua after Klitschko, I mean, I certainly had designs on just epically fun matchup. And I think now, not only is it not the 1970s landscape of heavyweights, but it's not even the 1990s landscape of heavyweights. I just think what we're seeing the more we get exposed to these guys fighting elite competition is their limitations, and that they're, you know, they're still interesting, they're still fun heavyweights, they still have some attributes that are worthy of being excited about, but they're a limited crop. And you'd think, I think the way to kind of remedy that from a marketing perspective is just get them fighting a lot more, because it'd just be so fun if we were back in like the early 1980s. I mean, you remember Tyson popping in, fighting for the title against Burbick and unifying the title, how often he was fighting. I mean, every 2-3 months he was getting in there. And I understand he was knocking everybody out, so it wasn't like there was a lot of wear and tear in between those fights that he was recovering from, but it's just become so standard, this sort of expectations for the fights that fans want to see and this glacial pace of making it happen. And when it does often happen, it's just so beyond the best buy date. And that's a very frustrating feature that I think boxing has stood out from other sports, where you just have organization to really meet what consumers want. And that's just not the way boxing functions. And, you know, while boxing is flush with still a lot of venture capital, a lot of weird money that's there, it could very quickly, the bottom could fall out and it could become a very different landscape. And I'm curious to see fighters who are being, I think, overpaid their market value, what they're going to do when they really have to, it returns to the concept of prize fighting and you're going to have to take risks to get it. I think there are ways you could do marketing. I don't understand why there isn't more of a philosophy towards prize fighting where a winner would take 70% and the loser would get 30 or 60, 40 or something like that, rather than these guaranteed purses where, I don't know, I think they could just incentivize action in a better way. Not necessarily like Dana White, where if there's more action, you know, a knockout or whatever, you get bonuses. I'm not for the bonus system of having a czar dictate everything. I just think the marketplace could dictate a better product in terms of the fights happening. And, it's still very frustrating because there's so much potential for a lot of good stuff. And especially coming off of, like, you know, one of the most important fights of the last 25 years, Mike Lee losing his undefeated record to Caleb Plant. Like, let's seize on that momentum.
I mean, you know, you just drop it on me, and I'm like, how do I recover from that, you know?
It's impossible.
It's like recovering from something Mike Lee throws at you, dude. It's just, it doesn't happen.
Unless you go to Subway and get some protein from cold cut sandwiches or something, you're not recovering.
Yeah, he's going to hit him with that cold cut combo. Bile! Yeah, I mean, you know... sometimes concern me. I make a lot of jokes about the boxing is dead shit. You know, I took the piss on Dylan Hernandez quite a bit. I'm pretty sure he either blocked me or muted me, which he totally should have done, like well within his right. Definitely should have done it. But that being said, you know, all the jokes aside and the ridicule aside, I do, you know, I do every so often kind of wonder, I do kind of grow concerned sometimes that kind of like you said, like the bubble will burst, that it can't just keep, it's not going to be a free for all forever. You know, it's like a store being looted, you know, it doesn't like the stuff runs out and somebody eventually winds up catching on that it's being looted or something, you know? So in boxing's case, it's just really wound up being a fantastic money laundering device for like over a century. And in that regard, like it's kind of, it just, we're all kind of sitting around looking at each other going like, all right, so when is the jig up, dude? I just want to make sure that I'm not the one getting in trouble when the jig is up, like, but I'm enjoying it in the meantime. So, you know, there does kind of feel like there has to be some sort of progress in that regard, a national commission, you know, a different way in which fights are carried out or matched or something. Because, the way that it's working is like there. I feel like there's a fairly clear message being sent, and it's rocky. it's kind of rickety because fans, while apt to being pissed off and also can kind of lash out, are also, you know, somewhat complacent and are in on a little wavelength where as long as you don't nudge them too far in either direction, it's fine because they're going to keep paying for DAZN, keep paying for ESPN Plus, etc. And as long as that happens, who gives a shit from a promotional perspective? But you just get the feeling that that can't last. Not the way that things are progressing, especially technologically. And it's like we got a year or so ago this DAZN business and people were like, yes. And now we're starting to realize like, shit, dude, if you start adding all of these things up that we now need to get to watch all the fights, starting to approach, you know, cable, like paying for cable status again. And that's not so fun. So, you know, from a number of different perspectives, like the matchmaking, the money, the fan, everything, like it's something feels like it will need to change. I just don't know what or how or when, and I hope that it's not, like, violently, you know?
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, you know, it's odd. I still haven't put my finger on exactly what's wrong with Deontay Wilder, because you think America's always clamoring for an exciting heavyweight who knocks everybody out. They get him. You know, he resorts to sort of WWE tactics with the bomb squad screaming and, you know, having the tags, the tagline of a scream that essentially becomes a meme for people to imitate, like a shitty ersatz version of Ric Flair's woo and that kind of thing. But, you know, he just can't sell tickets. And Deontay Wilder is what, 34 now? It's odd to me that you have somebody, I don't want to say that dominant, because, I mean, he just struggled again against Luis Ortiz. And, you know, Ortiz, what, definitely fought in the Cuban Revolution, maybe fought in the Spanish-American War of 1898, possibly repelled Columbus and the Armada that approached Cuba back in 1492. You know, so
I actually heard a rumor that he owes Che Guevara's dad a couple of pesos.
Yeah, I've heard that rumor as well. No, I mean, it really makes you consider potentially him taking over the Hall of Fame for what he's been able to achieve for a 500-year-old man. No, but Deontay Wilder, you'd think, you know, he's getting the exposure, he's getting all the shoulder programming to make fans see him, to see his personality. He has a tremendous highlight reel of knocking out a bunch of stiffs and some people that are kind of, you know, a great knockout of Tyson Fury, the Ortiz knockout. You know, this was enough for Tyson to have a great highlight reel of knockouts against, like, nobodies, of, you know, Glass Joes and the whole, like, menagerie that Mike Tyson's Punch-Out had of, like, lovable tomato cans. But for some reason, he's just not going over. And it's weird to me that you have a Southern champion from the same state where Joe Louis came from who has presence and is able to deliver on what fans say they want. They don't want a Klitschko style of fighting. They don't want Lennox Lewis. That's all boring. They want somebody who brings the brutality. And yet he is really struggling to sell tickets, even against competition where he's struggling again. You know, he's having issues. So it makes me think if somebody like Wilder can look like a superhero and has a superhero right hand cannon, and he can't sell tickets, and I don't know that he can really sell pay-per-views, and I'm not even sure, like, if he fought Joshua at this point, is that going to be a 2 million buy pay-per-view at $100? I don't think so. I don't know that it does a million. Maybe it does. Maybe, you know, in that neighborhood. But it's kind of odd when you have somebody doing everything we say we want an American champion to do in this country, and he's not really transcending the sport at this point. I mean, he's making good money, but it's a little bit of a bellwether for where boxing is, that a lot of the big names are making good money, but they're not generating money for the people who are supporting them. And I think the people who are supporting them, that apparatus is struggling a bit to figure out ways to market these guys. And I'm not sure exactly what's wrong, but you think social media allows these people to get so much more exposure than people had in the past, where it was revolutionary for Tyson even to his managers, Bill Caton and Jim Jacobs, to be distributing tapes of highlight reels. That was cutting edge technology at the time. Now all of these great knockouts can be disseminated instantly around the world, and it's not translating to people paying $100, $150, $300 to attend the fight. So I think that is real cause for concern. And I'm not trying to criticize what Deontay Wilder is doing. I think for his limitations, he's doing what you'd expect him to do. And all that's really missing is this lingering question mark of what is going to be the impact of him having this rematch in February against Tyson Fury. First fight was not a massive success. What is the effect if he gets an opportunity in the near future to fight Anthony Joshua? What's that like? Does Andy Ruiz come back? Does he bounce back, get in better shape, and earn a shot to fight Wilder? I like Wilder in that fight by a lot. So I don't know. That's my sense. Is globally, I feel like Joshua can make piles of money selling out England, fighting anybody. But in the United States, it's getting harder and harder. And in the UFC, you have 85% of wherever they're showing fights are filled out when it opens up. And in boxing, it's pretty routine to see about 60% of it empty until the main event. And the way these broadcasts are being done on DAZN are becoming notable by people who care about boxing for how haphazardly some of it's being dealt with, like the Canelo delay, where there's all these images of them lying on the couch, and these are not good looks for the sport, I think. And it could get a lot worse when the influx of cash is not there, and these guys sort of have to eat what they kill as far as creating successful shows, as opposed to the money is there and it's guaranteed.
Well, and two things, and the first is something you and I have talked about before. And what kind of worries me about that is that these shows wind up being perhaps not they might not being wind up being a blockbuster, but they wind up being successful enough. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like in business terms, like they're definitely two different things, but you can wind up making $400 million in one big chunk, or you could wind up making like 330, but you just take it way easier over the course of a year. You know what I mean? And so I think that's kind of the approach that a lot of these entities have taken. So these shows wind up being just successful enough so that they're not discouraged from doing them. So that Tyson Fury versus Deontay Wilder 1 doesn't wind up doing awful enough that they're discouraged from, using a similar model for a second fight or something like that, And so that winds up being a problem. Well, the second part was what you were talking about with Deontay Wilder. And as far as his marketability and what's wrong, some people might be listening and saying, well, who gives a shit? But, if you're kind of hinging your belief that, as the heavyweights go, so goes boxing. There is some truth to that in some regard. And the fact that a lot of American fight fans, pundits, media, et cetera, have been calling for an American heavyweight champion and saying that that'll be what renews interest in boxing stateside, et cetera, et cetera. This is pertinent discussion stuff here.
Yeah. And I mean, the fight that I'm looking forward to the most in 2020 that I think can really end this discussion of boxing is dead is today on Twitter. I think the seeds have been planted for Terrence Crawford to to fight the most dangerous journalist in boxing today, Mike Oettinger.
Oh, man, I was wondering if you were going to bring that up. I was honestly wondering if you were going
to. That was a pretty amazing thing to see come out. Anybody who hasn't seen this who's listening live, Crawford was being dogged by Coppinger for flagging Gervonta Davis. And Crawford just responded by saying, there you are, sucking dick again or something.
Yeah. But, I mean, I don't want to over explain because there's the whole thing about like where if you have to explain a joke, then it's no longer funny. And, you know, fair enough. But for anybody who's listening in, Mike Coppinger is famous reporter. Well, you know, mainstream reporter in boxing. I would say a frequent target. A frequent target for, you know, I don't know, just a frequent target. And so apparently he chimed in.
Oh, he's combative. He's combative. I mean, that's what I would say is he does voice strong opinions and he seems to enjoy being combative with fans, writers, and fighters alike. And this was one of the first times I saw a really noticeable response from a major fighter, and Bud Crawford certainly doesn't pull his punches anywhere in the ring or out, so it was interesting.
Sorry, actually, my kids walked around the corner like just for a moment, and I was like, wait, I can't really, I gotta kind of pull my punches a second here. I gotta word this cleverly. All right, point is here. The other night when Gervonta Davis had a hell of a time with Euriorchius Gamboa, which I'd love to get your thoughts on in a sec here, but he had a hell of a time with him, needless to say, and then Terrence Crawford kind of offered up his own opinion, which was, you know, albeit a not quite scathing, I would say, but clearly a strong opinion about Gervonta Davis and keeping him basically away from other fighters like Lomachenko in the wake of that performance. And Mike Coppinger, for whatever reason, found it necessary to defend Gervonta Davis, comparing, I guess, Terrence Crawford's career to Gervonta's and suggesting that Terrence Crawford has not taken many challenges and is kind of ducking people, more or less. Coppinger, being the frequent target that he is, was needless to say, I think it was easy for Terrence Crawford to shoot back something, but he chose to say, there you go, sucking dick. I mean, there's obviously a difference between him going, like, responding and being like, oh, well, what about so-and-so's career? And, you know, him just kind of, like, going right at his neck. And for that to happen on December 31st, it was kind of like, for many people who dislike Mike Coppinger, I'll stay neutral on this one just this once. I think it was kind of like a little extra post-Christmas present, if you know what I'm saying.
I mean, Coppinger is very good at getting people to respond to what he's putting out. So, yeah, I agree.
Exactly. Exactly. And he probably loves the fucking the attention. So,
yeah,
there you go.
He's a presence, but he's good at provoking responses, and he likes to engage with those responses, and... yeah, that was not the most diplomatic response, but I mean, he likes that kind of thing. There's some people in boxing that enjoy those kind of tussles. Generally, on social media, I'm almost exclusively a voyeur. I enjoy watching these kind of ridiculous scuffles, but I mean, to get to what Crawford's point was, is yeah, Crawford was flagging Gervonta Davis for fighting, I think his exact quote was, Tank fought a 38 out of prime fighter with a torn Achilles and barely KO'd him. Gamboa hasn't fought in a meaningful fight since he fought me in 2014. And after that, he got stopped with a guy with 12 losses, and y'all are making it seem like you do something spectacular. I think he I mean, that's kind of how I felt about the fight, is Gamboa looked totally shot even before his ankle went out, and or his boot went out, or both of them went out. Like, I mean, he had to get his boxing boot wrapped up, and
yeah,
he looked
that
terrible.
It was for me, like, just a really kind of strange fight. And like, sorry for anybody listening expecting just a pure, you know, a purist year of the end of the year awards show, but you know, we just got this fight, and we normally don't get fights on this time of the year too, so we wouldn't have any sort of recap. But anyway, yeah, it was kind of a strange fight. Look, Euriorchis Gamboa, you know, always been kind of chinny, always been the kind of fighter where it's like, you know, once the reflexes or speed go, like, he's got to go. Too explosive, too hard charging to last long. The kind of guy who's probably going to burn out quick, you know, that type of thing. And I think that probably his relative inactivity is what's kind of salved him so far. But a lot of people were expecting Davis to crush his ass. And rightly so, because Gervonta Davis is kind of beyond the point of being a contender, you know, well beyond the point of being a prospect. He's a contender, if not, I don't know how you want to rate the whole champion thing at this point, but regardless, a lot of people expected a lot from this fight. He was a very heavy favorite, and so for him to have any sort of trouble beyond, you know, just figuring him out in the early rounds was significant. And he did, you know, he knocked him down, hurt him early. And on top of knocking him down and hurting him early, I was skeptical of the whole Achilles thing, but it sounds like there was some relatively severe Achilles injury that Gamboa still fought with, and not only fought with, but took a handful of the middle rounds in which, for whatever reason, Gervonta Davis was just like, he looked like he was like losing confidence. I don't know. It was really weird. He almost looked like he like the moment was getting to him or something. And that was really strange, because it wasn't like Gamboa was even landing his Sunday punches and, you know, like, pop, pop. He was kind of just pop, pop, pop here. You know, it wasn't like – he wasn't like bang, bang. It was just kind of quick combinations, the stuff that he was landing. It was just that Davis was totally shutting down. And that's not the kind of thing that anybody really expected to see. So I guess the question beyond that becomes, like, you know, as far as the whole Coppinger thing, was he within his right as a journalist or whatever – to just voice his opinion and respond, or was he being, you know, kind of crossing the line and being dickish and kind of sniping at him? You know, was the sniping correct? I don't know. Just out of curiosity, especially since it's a talking point today and fucking hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, on this point, as I say, I quite strongly agree with Terrence Crawford, because I think Gamboa was completely shot. 38 years old.
About the fellatio, or?
Yeah, the fellatio is, I mean, no judgment. I mean, whatever makes people happy, I just thought Gamboa looked terrible.
Yeah.
He's always been an offensive fighter. Nothing about him noted defensively. He has a pretty weak chin. He took a lot of shots from Davis. Davis is a very heavy puncher. But Davis couldn't throw much. Stamina looked like, he kind of looked like a mini Anthony Joshua. He looked gassed. He looked concerned about his conditioning. And there was quite literally nothing in front of him in terms of any kind of threat. Gamboa has his hands down. His speed is nowhere near what it used to be. He's not throwing much. He has no ability to sort of put any weight onto his back foot to really transfer weight to have velocity on his punches. So there's no danger in just coming in and closing the show. And Davis was just so reticent to apply any meaningful pressure. It was just very, very odd. And, you know, Gamboa just stuck around round after round after round. And I thought it really wounded Davis's stock in this fight. So I don't think Crawford is in any way wide of the mark to say, what is the real achievement here? This was a showcase fight for Davis to have somebody who's well known, you know, having been, I think, knocked down 12 times in his career.
Yeah.
And even knocked down by a lot of guys who were not punchers. I mean, Davis clearly is a monster puncher in the lower weight classes, but you know that it for somebody as for somebody who looked as vulnerable as Gamboa did, Gervonta Davis just looked unable, unwilling to really do much about it or seize any of the advantages. I mean, you've got a fighter who's fighting essentially on one leg with his hands down with a glass chin, and you're not trying to close the show when that guy is also 38 years old and you're 25. I think it's kind of fair comment to be like, this isn't a good look for him. Like, this does not encourage you to think he's going to give Lomachenko a real challenge. So, or, you know, or Teofimo Lopez. I mean, either of those guys, I think, are licking their chops after seeing how maybe it was just a bad day for Gervonta Davis, but the stamina issues for somebody that young who looked in shape, I know he had some issues making weight, but it was kind of a weird, disappointing fight in a lot of ways. And I can't stress enough how bad Gamboa looked. And he was injured, and he was 38. And Davis had real problems for 10 rounds.
You know, he's always been chinny, as they say, and even in the sense that, like, he'll quickly go down even when not very hurt. He's a number of times just been pissed off when, you know, you knock him down and it pisses him off, and then you're in deep shit. But that's the kind of fighter he used to be, you know, a number of years ago, however many lost fights ago. However much lost potential ago.
He was a legit world champion who was very dangerous with extraordinary hand speed. And he's mean. He was a mean finisher who took a lot of chances to close the show despite having a pretty weak chin. But, I mean, that is many, many years ago.
Many years ago, you know, and it's just it was almost shocking because he's never, while never having great defense, when he was getting hit, it was literally the epitome of like a shot fighter where their head just like freezes. You know what I'm saying? Like their head, it's like suspended in fucking space. And even so, with a totally stationary target, Gervonta Davis was like, nah, I don't think so. You know, or at least just kind of sporadically, and I just didn't really get it. It wasn't a good look. So obviously there's a broad spectrum of reactions here, ranging from, nah, man, he looked totally fine, he got the knockout, to he looked like absolute shit, fuck that guy. Needless to say, we're far more in the middle here, but it has to be that you can't walk away from that fight if you're a logical person, having a whole lot of confidence in Gervonta Davis against some of these other fighters. I'm not so convinced of the people are kind of, I think, pulling the trigger a little too early on Devin Haney, like better stay away from Devin Haney. Like, hold on, like hang tight a little bit on that one too, you know, but Lomachenko, I don't think so. I don't think it, not right now. I mean, like let Vasily of deteriorate a little bit, but not right now.
I mean, I think that Devin Haney still is a very blue chip stock in boxing. I think he has huge upside, huge potential. I just always wondered about Davis just in terms of his attitude, his focus, his discipline. I think there's a lot of
there's a
minefield there. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry. I was just saying very legit, like very legit concern.
Yeah, just in terms of his character, and I mean, I hope he turns it around. I think he has a ton of potential, and I think he's a hell of a lot of fun to watch most of the time, certainly not against Gamboa. But I think that he's one of those people that, you know, most of those guys end up being comets. They're not able to really sustain the discipline to deal with getting the money, getting the recognition, the visibility, the pressures with becoming a champion, the pressures with becoming an elite fighter, dealing with elite level competition, and dealing with everything else outside the ring, which is much more problematic and precarious for them. Some of these guys are able to turn it around in a big way, and boxing becomes a real lifeline for them and a real centering device for them to bring everything into control. But for other people, it just intensifies issues inside and outside their life. And Davis gives a lot of indications that self-destruction is a real risk. So, you know, and he just kind of has a swaggering attitude about him as well that sort of postures toward wanting to give off that impression. You know, he did it at the weigh-in against Gamboa, shoving him for no reason. Nothing that provoked him there. He likes this image of being a bad boy, and sometimes that serves these guys. You know, I mean, Ali used to do it before fights. You know, he's mean, very mean at those tactics of intimidation, and Tyson was a master at it. But with Davis, you just have a sense that it's not an act, that this is sort of the way he wants to live his life. And I've had a strong sense when I've sort of seen him live at fights in particular, that this is a guy that it takes some energy for him to sort of stay on the straight and narrow. And I think if he's facing some of these other opponents who live very clean lives and lives that are very focused and calibrated entirely to maximize their potential in boxing, he could run into some real problems. And you know, Lomachenko too. Lomachenko has faced adversity in the ring a few times. He's been dropped. And I think just mentally, especially with his first loss against Salido, he just becomes so much tougher than he was then. And it really displays his character, you know, that he's not defined by just having an undefeated record. He's taking big chances. And he's even in a weight class where he's not able to exploit his obvious assets. You know, that would be much more showcased if he was a weight class or two lower, but he wants to take those risks to be great. And I think he would take real pleasure in sort of annihilating somebody like Gervonta Davis, given that Davis just optically is such a heavy-handed fighter and has this swagger and this presence about him. But these are, you know, the different characters that boxing offers is what makes it fun, but also tragedy is very often never far away from these guys who often emerged from it in the first place. They enter boxing.
Yeah. Well, and I brought up Errol Spence earlier, and I mean, that's obviously a perfect example of that. I mean, and a lot of people kind of didn't really see it coming either, unless you're paying attention to the boxing on social media stuff where you got to see him blasted in a few interviews. You wouldn't have known. It would have just been like, what? He was DUI in an accident? But luckily, as far as we know, he walked away okay. And is, again, as far as we know, should be coming back. Although that was kind of a strange interview from him the other night where he went from, yeah, I'm going to be coming back in February or March to coming back probably in summer. And then later on in the interview, he said, yeah, sometime in 2020. And I was like, does he not even know? You know, like, I mean, it sounds like he's kind of just throwing stuff out there. And then on top of that, it could just be his southern drawl, but is he a little bit drunk again? And I wasn't the only person who thought that either. A lot of people did.
No,
so
a lot of people
regardless, though, I mean, the point being with, you know, regard to Gervonta Davis, that with the trouble he's already been in as a fairly young guy, man, there's concern there for sure. And you know, then that's stuff that's totally apart, at least connected to, but apart from what happened in the ring. So, you know, he needs to get some shit together for sure. Not a very encouraging sign from him against Euriorkis Gamboa. Not an encouraging sign from Gamboa, who has previous links to, you know, anti-aging clinics and potential PED usage, and is now getting the kind of injuries in fights that tend to be more frequent when you have frequent PED usage, like Achilles, tendon, you know, other kind of ligament injuries tend to be far more frequent with a lot of types of PEDs, et cetera. And the dude is old now, so also not encouraging. And again, also kind of as a little aside, after he messed up his leg and he went to his corner, the immediate impression I got was that something was wrong and he wanted to quit. from the broadcast, and I agree with him. I don't think that they were wrong. It looked like that it was his shoe, and I agreed. It looked like it was just his shoe, but then, of course, afterward, it sounds like he does have some legit Achilles issue. But what I initially thought was he just wanted to quit. And now on social media, he apparently, or whoever it is who speaks for him, sent out a tweet that said, just for clarification, I wasn't trying to quit. I just wanted to move on into the fight, and I told my corner to tape me up, and I just keep going, which is not even remotely the case. His corner was the one who convinced him to stay in the fight, and they're the ones who taped his shit up, like, fucking two rounds after it happened or something. And on top of that, have to bring up the failure of Jack Reese, who is usually a pretty solid referee, to, like, not even go in and inspect or something when the guy's obviously, like, pointing to his leg. Like, you're not going to call a doctor in. You're not going to look at it yourself and be like, what's going on? You know, especially considering the language barrier, you're going to have to call an interpreter in and be like, hey, dude, what are they saying? What's his problem? Something, you know, bad form. And so that was kind of a botched thing. But, man, weird event. But, yeah, I don't know. It's the kind of thing where neither guy really goes forward looking great apart from Gamboa, who just looks tough. From fighting with a fucked up leg or whatever for however many rounds.
Yeah, no, I think that's all true, and I agree with you. From what I could hear, Gambo was saying as soon as there was this issue with his foot or with the footwear, you know, he said, I can't fight anymore. It seemed like the corner was the one that really sort of pushed him to get back out there and continue.
Yeah.
But I don't even know what the point was of him continuing, frankly, because he was a one-legged fighter, and the idea of sending somebody back out there in that kind of condition, like, I just don't understand what it really proves. Like, you know, if Davis had been in the proper condition to take advantage of that, which I don't, frankly, understand why he wasn't, especially with how much money is on the table with him going forward, and this was a fight that should have been a pretty easy fight for him. I'm kind of amazed that even Gamboa's corner, like, you really think if his Achilles tendon is ruptured, that he's going to pull off the fight in 11 rounds? Like, I can see if you're ahead on the card, the 10th round or the 11th round, there's some foreseeable, viable path forward to winning. But you're just going to get the guy brutally hurt in this situation, especially against a big young puncher. So it was, I don't know, it was just like an especially odd circumstance. I don't really understand what anybody was doing, and I agree. I thought the ref mishandled it. The corner, I don't know what the fuck they were thinking in sending him out. And, you know, what did we see? We saw a guy who couldn't even stand up running from somebody who didn't have the condition to throw punches at a wounded target for 11 rounds. So it's embarrassing, I thought.
No, I agree. And so hopefully that message is being sent to Davis and not being sent that, oh, you looked great, you got the W, and that's all that counts, because, you know, some shit needs to change, needless to say. But we would be stupid if we didn't at least bring up Jean Pascal. I mean, frickin' Jean Pascal. Dude, how old is that guy? What's going on? How long has Jean Pascal been around now? I mean, I don't even want to look. But, you know, Jean Pascal, looking kind of turning the clock back, at least in some regard, against Badou Jack, who I will admit, I think allowed himself probably to get outworked a bit too much at times during the fight. Jean Pascal took a controversial split decision over Badou Jack. So, fun fight. Fun fight for an old dude.
Yeah, unexpected. I mean, he is another decorated Canadian military man, a veteran of the 1812 burning down of the White House when Canada responded to the American invasion. We came down and burned down the White House. Pascal was actually the person who lit the first match to do that. So it's impressive. that 207 years later he was able to get this victory and overcome the political pressure, you know, based on his military past and, you know, the accusations of terrorism and that sort of thing about burning down the White House. No, I don't know how he turned back the clock the way he did. I agree. I thought that Badu Jack, it wasn't as good as we've seen him in the past. I mean, I like Badu Jack. I mean, he's an unusual fighter, but I mean, even he's getting up there too. 36 years old, few losses already, a few draws. I mean, it's kind of a weird career that Jack has had, but he does have, I think, the greatest name of the last 20 years in boxing. It's just so good. Who the fuck is named Badu Jack? It's just such an awesome name.
Yeah, it's definitely, it catches the eye, for sure. I remember him coming up on Showbox a number of years ago and being like, Badu Jack, I remember that. And, you know, here he is a number of years later, and he's, I have to admit, I kind of sold him short, especially after his first loss. You know, he wound up losing to Derek Edwards in 2013 or 2014 or something like that, on what kind of at the time looked like a little bit of a fluke or something. You know, it looked like, I don't know, a weight thing or something like that. And regardless, he's gone forward to not show the same kind of vulnerability chin wise, and generally be pretty successful. But yeah, he didn't really look 100% or something. And it definitely looked like he was wary of whatever it was Jean Pascal was doing, whatever zip code it was he was throwing punches from. But that's his thing, you know, like that's like literally Jean Pascal's calling card, is throwing punches from fucked up angles and, you know, still being fast enough to catch you and scare the shit out of you when you try to go offensive on him. So I got to give him credit for holding it together. I didn't think he won, but I thought he held it together well and gave a good account of himself, needless to say. And if they want to run that shit back, down for it. It was good enough to do it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you too. I mean, I understand there's some controversy with it, but I mean, it wasn't a robbery, but,
nah.
You know, Canadian. You have to give Canadians the benefit of the doubt.
Agreed.
And, you know, there's a lot of Canadian geese here on the East Coast that get slaughtered because they shit everywhere, and people should venerate them.
So speaking of shitting everywhere,
venerated. Yeah, sorry, go ahead. Just being
so speaking of shitting everywhere, let's shit our 2019 of the year awards everywhere.
Okay.
That wasn't a great segue, but I did what I could. So,
I mean,
in your opinion, who is the fighter of the year? Who is the fighter who did the most, or impressed the most, or accomplished the most? Who is in your opinion was the guy who did it for you?
Mike Lee.
I knew it.
Mike Lee. He showed all these doubters and these critics that have been out there slagging him, that he's this paper champion, that he's never earned anything that he's achieved, that coming from privilege, you know, that it's a racial thing, that he gets all the kind of the Subway commercials at halftime and everything. He showed us what he was worth. He showed us the kind of champion he is, not just for boxing, but just as a global ambassador, well, even just for the human race, what kind of person he is. No, I would give it to – I give Fighter of the Year – I think Canelo took it. I think he's the face of boxing. I thought what he did against Canelo was very exciting, and I think he's a good ambassador for the sport, and he's showing us he's still getting better. And I hope he gets more and more fights with you know, great competition. But he's putting together a hell of a goddamn resume, and he's somebody that does not let a lot of these fights marinate. He wants to prove something, and as much money as he's making, as much guaranteed money as he's making, he's taking some pretty big risks. So, you know, and I also like that the face of boxing, with Mayweather kind of gesturing he might return, it shows you the kind of champion that Mayweather is, that he would not go anywhere close to Canelo right now. Nowhere near where he takes a fight against Canelo right now. Right? And you can say,
yeah,
oh, he's smart, he's smart. But I like this, that if the roles were reversed, Canelo would take the fight. And I like that we have, I'm not saying that Canelo is a better fighter than Mayweather or his career is better than Mayweather's, but I like that we have somebody like that right now as the face of the sport, as opposed to Mayweather cherry-picking opponents and bragging about all the money he made, but the fights that he made and how he fought them were not something that fans have really relished looking back on in this, what are the great fights of the decade. Nobody's going back to any of the fights that he partook in the 2010 to 2020 going, oh my God, we need to rewatch those. I hope that the roaring 20s can imitate what Mayweather was able to achieve in terms of fan-friendly fights. And Canelo's putting together fan-friendly fights. He's exciting.
Yeah.
And, I mean, as far as the best fight, it's hard for me to imagine topping the Donaire Inoue. I just thought that was an amazing fight. So, what about you with the top fighter, top fight? Who are you going with?
No, I agree on both. I think that if Naoya Inoue had been busier in 2019, that I would have been, I probably would have been closer to calling him Fighter of the Year, because he absolutely destroyed a top five or 10, you know, bantamweight earlier in the year, and then had an absolute war with Nonito Donaire, who obviously showed that he has more in the tank, even if just in terms of converting heart, will, and fucking pure testicle into whatever it was he needed to show in the ring, that, you know, those two things were pretty significant. And especially, you know, considering it was part of the also significant tournament at bantamweight on DAZN, the World Boxing Super Series. But having just two fights, it's kind of like, well, then I would probably have to lean toward Canelo and what he accomplished. You know, Sergey Kovalev's post-fight ranting and bullshit notwithstanding. you know, I just think that it was probably more important, probably a little bit more, had a little bit more of an impact. Manny Pacquiao, great comeback type of win over Keith Thurman. Also, should be in the contender for, you know, one of the better fights of the year, but I didn't think that he should have gotten Fighter of the Year for that. And then Josh Taylor also should be kind of an honorable mention, a very honorable mention, with beating the crap out of a couple guys in Ivan Brancic and Regis Prograis. Also very, you know, significant wins and winning that tournament too. But yeah, I'd probably go with Canelo because of the platform, really. I mean, I guess that might not totally be fair if you're looking at just accomplishments, but it's pretty close.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I thought what Pacquiao did against Thurman was very, very impressive, that he's still at this level at his age.
Yeah, and it was fun, too.
And it was fun, you know, and Thurman is still a very dangerous fighter. I mean, Pacquiao has no business putting on that kind of performance against where Thurman is at right now. I mean, Thurman is another guy that I think Mayweather was ducking, and Pacquiao has, like, the resume of, like, four Hall of Famers in one career. That's the kind of champion he's been. He lost a few times or whatever, but you look what he's been willing to take on and what he's achieved. I mean, I think we will look back 10 years, 20 years from now, that it was a very special time to be there while Pacquiao was on the way up, and let alone on the way up, I mean, even where he's at on the tail end, the twilight of his career, he's still exciting. He's still dangerous. He's still doing things.
Still relevant,
And he's still relevant. So, and, I mean, I'll go out on a limb here. I think if he fights Mayweather at this point, I think he wins the fight. I think that where he's at and where Mayweather slid, I'd love to see Mayweather take that fight. I think it'll be a lot more competitive this go-round.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. Not quite an accomplishment on the level of Fighter of the Year, in my opinion, but a lot of fun. As far as like the fight of the year, I agree. It probably has to be Naoya Inoue versus Nonito Donaire. I mean, that was the kind of fight where, I mean, there were a number of actually really fun fights this year. Ramirez Hooker, Taylor Progres was pretty fun too. Beterbiev, Gvozdik, hell, I mean, Fury versus Deontay Wilder for probably like 4 or 5 rounds was pretty fun. There was a number of fights that were actually really fun, but that Inoue versus Donaire was the only fight where I was watching it, at least on that level, and thinking, holy shit. Like one of those kinds of things where you feel like you're watching something special as you're watching it. And, there have been so many fights where I've been watching them and going, damn, this is fun. But there aren't that many fights where I watch them and I'm just like, wow. And that was one of those fights, at least for me, for sure. And so that to me, kind of has to be, for me anyway. Let's see, we had a handful of pretty good knockouts too. Did you have a favorite knockout?
Ooh. Yeah, that's a good one. I think I would give it to. I think the most iconic knockout of the year for me was just watching a grossly overweight substitute, Andy Ruiz, take out this titanic Anthony Joshua at MSG when he's this massive underdog. I just think, like, it was so unexpected, and the joy on his face doing it was unusual. Normally you see this kind of posturing where it's anger at the moment or relief when these guys knock another guy out, but when it's this long shot Rocky moment, and unlike Rocky Apollo One, Ruiz pulls it off and just keeps dropping him again and again and again. That was just such a bizarre moment to be there live and to hear a crowd responding to it, where everybody is just like, we all went into it after the weigh-in just thinking, oh my God, like this is going to be a slaughter, and this is going to be really embarrassing, and this is bad for the sport. This is really bad that this is who Anthony Joshua is fighting instead of who he should be fighting. And then that happened. So I have to go with that just because the gravity of that moment and the way Ruiz embraced that moment with such joy and what it represented, especially to the Latino community, was just very, very special and dramatic and fun. And, he's sponsored by Twix or Snickers or whatever the fuck. Like, it was hilarious. And I don't think that moment is ever coming back for him, because that's why. At the elite level, you don't see the Andy Ruizes of the world ascending to the top when they note that their main focus in life is sleeping with hookers and getting high to the promoter, Barbera. So yeah, I love that moment. I love Canelo's knockout against Kovalev. I mean, it's so dramatic, and Kovalev is one of those guys that when he does get dropped, it's just. There's something about it that is really intense to watch, because he's such a, he has a lot of willpower, and he's been such a destroyer in the ring. To watch him fall, it has a lot of drama to it, and just being so much the bigger man against Canelo, that was a big moment. And Wilder, Wilder creates a lot of magical, arresting moments with what he can do with that tremendous right hand of his. As well, but I'd have to give it to Andy Ruiz, though. What about you?
I think that's fair, especially with the impact. There were a couple other good ones though too. I thought that what's his name? Dominic Brazil went down pretty good against Deontay Wilder. That was pretty solid. One
Yes,
of the
he
most
did.
what's that?
I said, yes, he did. He sure did.
One of the more brutal knockouts of the year was Derek Chisora versus our boy Artie Spielka. Man, that was rough. But like I guess if I'm looking at it serious or whatever, I generally look at the quality of the fighter being knocked out too, you know, like the quality of the fight and the quality of the fighter being knocked out and that kind of thing. And I'd have to say that it was probably, at least for me, going to be Deontay Wilder versus Luis Ortiz. I mean, there were a number of pretty damn brutal knockouts this year, as there are every year, but that was probably the best knockout with, like, the best fighter involved or something like that. And also wound up being fairly needed, necessary on Deontay Wilder's part. So it was exciting. I liked it. Upset of the year is obviously going to be Andy Ruiz Jr. versus Anthony Joshua, no question.
Yeah, no question. I mean, that was the biggest upset of the 21st century in boxing. I think that's a safe statement.
Are you heading out to Times Square?
That is probably the last place on earth that I would go at any point. Like, I mean, any day of the year, but especially today, it would absolutely.
I don't know what your habits are, man. I don't know.
Well, secular anti-humanist, I think, governing principle.
Fair enough.
Plus, if I wanted to, where I would have probably had to have gone out there at 1 p.m. to get a spot. No, I don't do that shit. I might just. I'm in Washington Heights, so it's gonna be. I don't know if you can hear it, but like, the Dominicans are getting ready. Like, I mean, I'm hearing 7 different beats from all directions around this neighborhood.
I'm actually kind of surprised that there hasn't been more noise. Of course, I just jinxed myself, but like, I moved out into the suburbs, into you know, maybe about 20 minutes or so from Portland, across the river in Washington, and I live right next to this big park. And that is the favorite place for people to light off, like, fucking professional status fireworks, which scares the shit out of my dogs, you assholes. Just in case any of you listening live in Vancouver, Washington, please stop. Anyway, I'm kind of surprised that shit hasn't happened already, because that was pretty brutal on 4th of July. Like, literally brutal. My dog ran away from home. It was awful. We got him back. Everybody's okay, but holy shit. Anyway, I don't know. We're kicking it tonight. I only have one question to ask you for the fucking upcoming year, though, man. Is that is paper or plastic?
For just everything?
For everything. I mean, I'm kind of role-playing Bobby Chez here.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, oh. I thought there was some Portland tie-in.
No, not at all. I'm just... No, Bobby Chez is working in the supermarket, so, you know, you got to ask.
No, that's where I'm headed. I mean, it's another hour and a half, hour and 40 minutes until New Year's. So I'm headed out to Jersey. I'm going to the CVS, and I'm just going to issue a challenge right now. I think he's ready to step back into the heavyweight division, you know, top 30, and I'm willing to be the sacrificial lamb to fight him. You know, and I'm going to do everything I can to study so that intellectually I have some hope in hell of competing against that kind of Mensa lightsaber. That he, you know, I'm going to work at all these polysyllabic words that he's going to throw at me so I can send the best I can. So I don't make a fool of myself in this celebrity boxing match. And the winner gets Mike Lee.
If that's not the kind of win that propels you up the rankings, or at least up somebody's fucking bankruptcy lawyer staircase, and then I don't know what is. I don't know what is, Bryn.
Well, I just think, I mean, if I lose, the loser in this charity boxing match with proceeds going to Mothers for Drinking and Driving, which I think is a disgusting organization, it disgusts me that Bobby Chez supports them, let alone is this unpaid ambassador for that organization. I am willing to accept a 1 week term being his designated driver. And, I think that's good for everybody except Mothers for Drinking and Driving.
Who we don't promote in any regard.
No, We support the other one against drinking and driving. Of course we do, Patrick. I don't even drink.
Well, so I can go drink. I'm going to go eat some dinner. And on that note, everybody, thank you for listening to our nonsense. I don't know why you keep doing it. And, you know, despite all of this random bullshit we're talking, please don't drink and drive, especially not tonight. It would be super foolish of you to do. And everybody, we wish you the best 2020. We hope you had a great 2019, at least better than ours, because as you could tell, we're two miserable bastards. I think that's fair to say.
And I think, moreover, it's not just don't drink and drive, because we know you wouldn't drink and drive. No idiot would drink and drive.
Never.
The more important thing is if you're, for some reason, passing through New Jersey, beware of one guy in particular who very well might be drinking and driving.
Look out for that old-ass fucking Chevy Nova. Look out for it.
You want to make it to 2020, don't go to New Jersey tonight, because he could be anywhere.
Stay out of New Jersey, because you also might get reported by Ryan Sangalia.
We need some special effects that we have the siren and the sound of a car crashing, I think, to conclude each episode. If this is going to be the constant meme, probably to all our listeners, just complete annoyance. But
it really would, and it would be fitting in a whole number of regards. You know, like we end the episode in like the most annoying way possible to every single time. So it's just like it's a car wreck.
Okay, well hold on, because I think I can hear. I mean, I'm right on the Hudson River. I've told you that. Like I'm on Riverside Drive. I'm listening really closely. Patrick, can you hear from my microphone? Well, first is going to be actually a public service announcement from Patrick Stewart. But after that, we're back to the river.
Oh, there you go. Oh, there's the cops.
They're going to get Bobby.
Nah.
Bobby. Do it. Come on, Chappy.
They're coming for you, Bobby. Don't
do it, Bobby. We're evil. This is not good.
No. We'll try to do better in 2020. We'll come up with better Bobby jokes.
All right, guys. Everybody have a great year. Patrick, you too and your family. And your
you
dog,
too,
who I'm glad is back home.
Thank goodness. All right, everybody.
Yeah.
And also, as always, I got to do a little spiel. If you're on Twitter, do us a favor. Follow Bryn on Twitter, Brynicio, BRINICIO. Follow me at Patrick M. Connor. And also, if you're on Facebook, go to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page there. Throw us a like. Whatever, you know, little podcasting app you use, give us a little rating or whatever on there. We would appreciate it. And look for us in 2020. Like Barbara Walters, motherfuckers. What's up? All right, Bryn.
And go ahead and follow Bobby Chez on Twitter, too.
Yeah, go find his ass, and don't tag him in any of our conversations. Frankly, I'm getting scared.
Ever. Yeah, blame Bobby is okay, but just not Bobby.
Yep, hashtag blame body. Well, no, hashtag blame Bobby, not blame body, because that's what happens afterwards after he fucking finds us. All right, everybody, take it easy.